Well, it's really good to see Ben looking well and on the mend. You might want to pray for him this week out of perhaps some of your own interest, because if Ben's not well enough to preach next Sunday, you'll have had trick or treat during the week, and then next Sunday you'll get triple treat or whatever. It could be yours truly back again. So you've got a vested interest, I'm sure, in praying for Ben. And it is good to see him recovering, so we're pleased about that. The reward from last week for surviving five chapters is you only need to survive one today. So there you go. But I wonder how you go with the four questions that were your contribution to the sermon. In those five chapters, we asked, what do we see of God's heart? And it was certainly, you see something of that reflected in the songs this morning, don't you? And then the question was asked, what's he looking for in his people? What's he finding within his people? And then, what's he going to do about it? And you saw through those five chapters how people were just an agony to God. Their hearts completely corrupted. But God doesn't give them up. Disciplines them, surely and truly. But what's he going to do about it? He's still going to show mercy. It is just incredible. So Isaiah shared those issues before sharing what I guess is the high watermark of his life. So why would he do that? You know, I mean, we kind of, our day and era is you rush to share God and us. And he's just gently said, no, I want to put the picture of God and the nation first. And he wants to have God front and center rather than his own experience of God. Now I want you to just pause for a moment and do a little recent history with me, a bit of a memory quiz. Do you recall how the British Empire mourned the death of Queen Elizabeth II? It was a very powerful time, and I think there were two outstanding aspects. First up, there was the loss of a stable person of deep integrity, and even a person of faith with a relationship with God. And the second thing was not only the loss, but the second big factor was the sense of uncertainty as her son ascended to the throne. Do you recall it? It was there. We've lived through that. Well, some have said that Uzziah was the most stable king since Solomon. And so Isaiah is giving us not just a time stamp, but at chapter 6, verse 1, a very cryptic state of the nation, if you like, a clue that the nation is in an era of uncertainty after a very stable rulership. Here's verse 1 of chapter 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Uzziah is no longer on his throne, but Isaiah is clearly shown that our God is still on his. Don't let that slip past you unnoticed, because we are also living in a time that I believe we are witnessing the end of Western empires. And there's little point really in trusting in other nations. Our trust must be in the God who sits enthroned above it all. And Isaiah has much to say in coming chapters about God moving nations around as though they were just pieces on his chessboard. So he gives us a description of God, and it's very brief, but quite powerful. All he said is that God is seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. There it is. That's the description of God. That's all that he tells us about God. I sometimes entertain the sneaking suspicion that God really is an Aussie in disguise, because he just loves understatement, doesn't he? I mean, how can you understate the highest and mightiest God? By simply describing him as seated on a throne, high and exalted, the train of his robe fills the temple. It's not dissimilar, is it, to the physical aspects of the cross? When it comes to looking at the cross, what physically happened at Jesus' death, those things are so deeply understated, because the focus needs to be on the why and not the how. There's sufficient of the how, but it's deeply understatement. Our God is on his throne, and that, my friends, says it all. Therefore, what should we be? Strangely enough, Isaiah gives us a much more detailed description about God's companions, the seraphs, and what they're up to. So here it is in verse 2. Above him were seraphs, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." You might just enjoy pondering their role before the throne of God. You know, are these the kind of royal guardsmen? Are these the, you know, the pageantry, if you like, that announces the monarch is coming? Is that what they're doing? You know, the kind of the palace guards or the beef eaters around the crown jewels, or the US guards at the tomb of the unknown soldier? Powerful roles for sure. Keeping others at a safe distance? Ensuring proper respect? Oh, I think so. Adding a sense of the sacred? Well, we're simply not told. So just stretch your mind. Let it stretch, work it through during the day. What were these seraphs doing? The next thing we're given is the seraphs' impact on the temple. Look at it in verse 4, it's massive. At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and the threshold shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. I have a sneaking suspicion that what it's really saying to us is, you want to be careful coming in here. I mean, would you enter a building if the door frames and the threshold was violently shaking? Would you go in? I think you'd hang back a tad. That may be something of what's here. And I think they're saying to us, in here what we have is holy, holy, holy. Careful, careful, careful. But we're not told. And the temple is filled with smoke as they speak. Extraordinary, isn't it? What we are given, though, is the impact of this on Isaiah. Verse 5, "Woe to me," I cried, "I'm ruined. I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. I'm shot to bits." We're six chapters in, and the focus is not on Isaiah. It's not even about his call. It's about a holy, holy, holy God and his relationship to him, to his people. And Isaiah knows that he is done for until an act of cleansing comes from God through the seraph. "And then one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, 'See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for.'" Has God cleansed you, made you clean? For Isaiah, this was symbolic but deeply personal. A cleansing coal from the altar of God for his lips, for proclaiming his ministry. For us, a son is given in our place to redeem us and buy us back. So it's worthwhile asking yourself the question this morning, am I cleaner now than I was this time last year? How's my life before God? Where are the relationship progress markers where I can say I'm humbler before him, I'm seeking him more, I'm wanting him in a stronger and richer way? Yes, there'll be divots, but they're not the focus. They're not the trend in the graph. The desire for God is growing stronger this year than it was last. I hope that's true of you. Now that Isaiah is cleansed, at least his lips are, there's a dialogue with God. It's really interesting, isn't it? "Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send and who will go for us?' And I couldn't help myself. I just said, 'Here I am, send me.'" It's a much different response to Jeremiah and Moses, isn't it? You know, Moses, can you find somebody else? Jeremiah, I'm far too young. You know, not me. Pick somebody else, you know. It's almost as trying to get a church roster together, isn't it, you know? The great reluctance. But here's this guy saying, no, I'm up for it, you know, let's get into it. So now God says to him, "Go and tell this people, be ever hearing, but never understand, be ever seeing, but never perceiving. Make the heart of this people calloused. Make their ears dull and close their eyes. Otherwise, they just might see with their eyes and with their ears, hear with their ears, and they just might understand with their hearts and turn and be healed." Let's spend some time around this because it's not an easy concept. What does it tell us about the messenger? About Isaiah, what does it tell us about him to kick off with? Well, it tells you absolutely nothing. But imagine with me for a moment being told that your work will fail, that you're going to have zero response. That would sap the energy out of most of capitalism's employees, wouldn't it? Dr. Ben. Not one patient completes the script. Yeah, listen to him, but don't do a thing about it, you know. Put the script in the bin on the way out the door. Not one patient takes an x-ray or a test or whatever. They all go off to Dr. Google, or another doctor at least. What's going to happen to Dr. Ben's heart? What do you think? Or his friend in the corner over here, lawyer Laura. No one takes her advice. In fact, they all do the opposite. The magistrates and the judges and the other lawyers all mock her and turn down every brilliant document she puts forward. What's going to happen to lawyer Laura's self-esteem? We're going to all be praying for Brad as he's trying to put band-aids on her, I think, you know. And what about Isaiah's self-esteem? Nobody's going to listen to you, Isaiah. In fact, tell them not to. So here's something we need to address before we even start looking at the message itself. It's us, the messengers. You see, we have to ask ourselves, what motivates you and I to keep on sharing the Christian message? Because capitalism and our world says to us, it's outcomes, it's all outcomes. You know, whatever you're doing, there's got to be an outcome, otherwise you're doing something wrong. God's kingdom says something massively different. And I confess I have huge issues with church development schemes where they sit down and try and take the whole journey on a whole church on a journey of a process, looking at the business model and saying, you know, well, what are you doing and what are your key performance indicators and how's all this going? How are you measuring A against B and all of the rest of it? And so God's kingdom seems to be running on a commercial basis and not on a biblical one. And sadly, you can see whole denominations going in this direction now. And when the outcomes, the KPIs are not met, well, if you're motivated by KPIs in God's kingdom, I'm sorry to say, you're motivated for the wrong reasons. What was motivating Isaiah? His grasp of God's heart. His grasp of who God is. Isaiah's a very modest, personal kind of fellow. Jeremiah wears his heart on his sleeve. He's called the weeping prophet for good reason. And in Jeremiah chapter 20, Jeremiah tells you what it's like to be a prophet. Chapter 20, verse 9, he says, "Whenever I speak, I cry out proclaiming violence and destruction." In other words, God is going to sort his people. "So the word of the Lord has brought me insult and reproach all day long." You know, it's a rotten job, he's saying. "But if I say, no, I won't mention him or speak any more at his name, his word is in my heart like a fire shut up in my bones, and I'm weary holding it in. In fact, I can't." And then he talks about those who are going to have a crack at him. And he says, "But the Lord is with me like a mighty warrior." In other words, because of God in me, I can't stop telling about God. So what motivates Isaiah, given that he's been told the outcome of his life's work? The heart of God. The holiness of God. You see, this is more than a vision that he's had. Because we're not told it was a vision. So my money's on it's real. He saw God and he shouldn't have lived. And God has made him clean and accepted him. And Isaiah is now sold out for God. It probably mocks KPIs. And that's what you and I need so that we can thrive even when we're planted in the toughest of places. In youth work, in pastoring, in leading ladies' Bible studies, in Sunday, leading Sunday school, in church admin, in evangelism, as we seek to share the gospel with others. It's not a goal, it's not a glowing outcome vision, it's not a dream or a plan that moves us, but a heart that knows God's heart. And any heart that knows God's heart is unstoppable, completely sold out to the cause, unstoppably faithful. Even though he slays me, yet will I trust in him. These chains, said another, are for his glory. For me, he said, living is Christ. Another one said, though you blokes meant it to me for evil, God meant it for good, for the saving of many lives. God has used it for his good. That's how we persevere through any ministry. Lo, I am with you always, right up to and even including the very end of the age. So that's the messenger. Both Isaiah and you and I need great confidence in God alone. Well, next we better have a look at the message itself. let's rethink it. He said, verse 9, go and tell these people, be ever hearing, but never understanding. Be ever seeing, but never perceiving. Make the heart of this people callous and make their ears dull and close their eyes. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn and be healed. Okay. What does it tell us about the content of the message? Just look at it again. A quick tick. Only verse 9-10. What's the content of the message? I'm going to respond to all the blank looks because it's a blank message, isn't it? There's nothing about the message. Absolutely diddly squat. Nothing about the content of the message, but the focus is on the public response to the message. Do you see it? Go and tell them, and this is how they're going to respond. What am I going to tell them? Well, hang on a bit. This is how they're going to respond. Okay. It's deeply negative, isn't it? So Isaiah's job description is no more than this. Number one, tell them not to get the message. And number two, ensure that they don't. Aren't you glad even a primary school teacher or something like that? Dr. Ben, tell them not to bother getting the script filled, not to bother getting the scan done. Don't bother about the booking chemo. In fact, ensure they go off to alternative health people and chat with them. Kind of starting to get the drift of what Isaiah's being told. Now, let me try and state the obvious. We got something pretty weird here, haven't we? I mean, you got every right to be feeling a little bit of disquiet, saying, oh, I'm not quite getting a handle on all this. Having just said that they're not going to connect with your message, Isaiah, don't forget that I want you to add another 60 chapters to your book. I hope you're struggling a little, because it's a healthy struggle. I'm sure if Wally were here, he would say, this is signature God. And we go, hello, 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 what have we got? I hope you feel God messing with your mind a little bit, because his ways aren't our ways. His thoughts are higher than ours. Now, to be fair, we're only halfway through the concept, but we've got to deal with it bit by bit as we go. It tells us that God is prepared to meet resistance, that he knows the message isn't going to be heard. But we're not quite so ready for that, are we? To be told that people are going to resist and resist and resist and push back, not want to listen. But it also tells us, in some of the translations, which I think are a bit more accurate, that number one, that God speaks in paradoxes. I think we understand something of that. But it also says that God actually causes them. So come on a quick journey with me, I hope, and look at God's track record with paradoxes. Abraham. I'm now going to call you Abraham, exalted father. So here comes a camel train because they're living on the international trading route. And here comes a camel train, and off comes Abdullah, and he goes over and says, "I'm Abdullah. Hi, I'm Abraham. Exalted father. Wow, beautiful wife you have. You must have many children. Where are they all?" Not yet. Probably best answer he can come up with. Paradox? And then Abraham's sitting a little bit glum around the campfire that evening, and God says, "Look up, buddy, you know. Milky Way. Have a go. See how many of them you can count. You're going to have more kids than that." So believing God, he rubs his hands together and comes inside, and Sarah goes, "Oh no, Abraham, please." Is this God paradoxical or what? Okay, Abraham, go down the beach and count the grains of sand there. Good job he didn't go to Lucky Bay. I mean, it's like powder, you know, you couldn't count the grains on one finger, let alone on the whole beach. Okay, Abraham, is that not enough for you? Go to 80 Mile Beach, you count them all up there if you like. But I don't have any, God, no children. And you call me Mega Dad, you know. I hope you enjoy the paradox, God, but it gets tough sometimes. Abraham, take your son, your only son whom you love. A paradoxical God? Moses, preserved, floating down the river, educated, trained, groomed by God, called by God, and then God ready to kill him. And there's nary a commentator that'll touch it. A paradox, isn't it? What am I trying to do with you this morning? I'm wanting you and I to appreciate that our massive God is far, far beyond our grasp. If we can accept it, it goes like this. Our logic, not God's logic, but our logic is flawed. And we all find that hard to take, because you've no idea how much I rely on my logic. But my logic is flawed, and God's isn't. Can you trust God when He isn't making sense? When He's not adding up? Can you say to yourself, it might just be my logic is where the problem is? And the problem's not with Him, because He knows the end from the beginning. Come with me to an obvious place about logic that doesn't add up from God. He so loved the world. How can He do that? How? He gave His one and only Son. Is this logical? That whoever believes, all you have to do, believe. Is this logical? Won't perish, but will have life eternal. Is that logical? God didn't send His Son into the world to condemn it, but to save the world through His Son. I'm sure we all bow in reverence and awe and holiness and say, what a wonderful God. 2 Corinthians 5 verse 21 puts it even more clearly. God made Him who had no sin to be sin for us. Is that logical? So that in Him we might become nothing less than the righteousness of God. Logical? Oh, I want to bow and worship. Oh, I'm in awe of this, that God would do this. But logical? And then look at Him defeating death. He just took it head on and stepped right into it and conquered it. It's an amazing picture, isn't it? You know, as death is trying to squeeze Jesus into the grave, what happens? Life just spills out of the local cemetery and they all get up and go home. You read it, it's there. Imagine that. I've been to two funerals this last week. I can't imagine if one of them turned up at home and said, well, what's cooking? You know, I haven't had a meal for a while. Worms are biting. This isn't logical either, is it? But He takes on death and dies and comes back from the grave, and death is now powerless and He is all powerful. This is the God who holds you in the hollow of His hand and will not let you go. You see, our God knows that anyone who could, who might, who possibly would believe will be saved. That's how much power is in the message that Isaiah is going to be carrying and that you and I carry. And as I've said, when we know the message and the power of it, we are unstoppable. So to explain this really tough, challenging concept, what did I just do? I took you on a brief journey where we could watch God in action and see just how He is. He closes eyes, He shuts mouths, He deafens ears. And now you know why His Son opened the ears of the deaf and the eyes of the blind and the dull minds, and they were healed and made new again. We also have to be aware of this, that we meet this concept here in Isaiah 6, 9 and 10. We meet it at least five more times in the New Testament. One of those was read to us right at the beginning. Do you recall it? Now, these very words are quoted by both Jesus and Paul, and Jesus is quoted in every gospel and Paul just once in Acts. And it's fair to say that both of them have met with the living God, isn't it? And I would encourage you to look those five references up this afternoon. It's easy. You just Google, where is Isaiah 6, 9 and 10 used in the New Testament? Bingo, you got it. So that's the easy part. And while you're pondering, ask yourself, who was it that opened the ears of the deaf, gave sight to the blind? And ironically, you'll go back and you'll find he was reading Isaiah, wasn't he, at the start of his ministry. You should enjoy mulling that and stretching your soul and also asking yourself and asking God, why did Jesus and Paul just use part of the idea here and not the whole lot? And I'm sure you'll revisit that idea more than once. Do your soul good. However, wait, there's more. You know, God's not done yet. I hope you read the rest of verse 10, which says, otherwise they might just hear with their eyes. See with their eyes, hear with their ears, that helps. Understand with their hearts and turn. And once they turn, I will be true to myself and to my word, and I will heal them. Not I might, I will. Well, we saw it last week. In the middle of judgment, mercy. Now, do you recall God having said, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy? And we watch him here balance that with such a lavish, undeserved, and complete mercy that our whole being just shudders. For who has grace so rich and free? It's intriguing, isn't it? God doesn't spell out the message. In fact, it's not even mentioned. But you're all pretty sharp pencils. You can see between the words. He has to discipline his people. He has promised them that he would. And he is. He has to discipline them, and he will. But he doesn't have to have mercy. But he knows his own heart. And whatever the cost to himself, he will have mercy. And now he gives instructions that his message is to be concealed until he's ready to release it. It's not only Daniel that has that message. It's tucked away here as well. So you saw have you seen how the chapter ends? So then I said, Isaiah, for how long, O Lord? And he answered, until the cities lie ruined and without inhabitant, until the houses are left deserted and the fields are ruined and ravaged, and until the Lord has sent everyone far away and the land is utterly forsaken. And though one tenth remains in the land, it will again be laid waste. Even that will be cold. But as the terebinth and the oak leave stumps when they are cut down, so the holy seed will be the stump in the land. What's he saying? My judgment is going to be thorough and absolutely complete. I'm going to judge my people. I'm sorry, but they're going to get it. However, it doesn't stop there. Our God reducing his people down to an impossible minimum. Well, we've seen that before, haven't we? With Gideon, remember? Jonathan and his armor bearer took on a whole army. David's mighty men against droves. And you've seen it in church history, where churches look absolutely dead. And all of a sudden the Spirit of God moves. And there's deep revival. It's unbelievable what God will do. And you and I know it when God moves, don't we? I can remember personally, faithful servants of God, Sunday school teachers, youth group leaders, zealous evangelists, great gospel presentations, and my heart stone cold dead. To my shame, I recall a Sunday school teacher of many years giving up because of a certain unteachable, disruptive school-age brat. Until God was ready. And I recall that cocky brat of 19 years of age pleading with God to show me mercy. Help me repent, to turn. And during what was a long and tedious sermon, I heard God say, "Gavin, I love you." And I was just done for. I knew then that his son had given his life in my place, that I was forgiven. And from then on, sold out into him. "If you're going to do that for me, God, you got the whole lot. Shabby as it is, it's all I've got and all I can give." But just like you, I've watched countless non-Christian friends hear the gospel and mock it and deny it and abuse God. And I'm not alone. Many of my pastor mates and you guys too sow and sow and sow faithfully. But we know that God will give the increase when he's good and ready. Jesus' ministry wasn't based on KPI factors and low-hanging fruit. In fact, I think the only low-hanging fruit he collected was Zacchaeus, if I'm kind of right. It seems to me that it's not until the book of Acts that we see the fruit of Jesus' ministry, and that's worth pondering. Because one of the best pieces of fruit was the sourest looking fruit you could ever see. Until God opened his eyes and says, "This Saul of Tarsus is my chosen servant." So it is that an encounter with God helps Isaiah see that, tough as it will be, we have one mighty, tough, all-conquering God. Never ever forget where the chapter ends. As the terebinth and the oak leave stumps when they're cut down, so the holy seed will be a stump in the land. A multinational corporation has gone in and done its land clearing. You can imagine what it looks like, stripped bare. But there is one stump, just one stump out there, Isaiah, which is a holy seed. And guess what, Isaiah? No matter how badly man treats God, God will win. When he is ready, no one will stop him. And 60 chapters still to come. And it's the most quoted book in the New Testament. And it's all about the depth of the heart of God and the massive power of God and the indescribable love and holiness of God, as we've been singing about this morning. Our message is tough, but our Lord and Savior is tougher. And not only that, he is also gracious and pardoning and forgiving. What a God. We should just bow and thank him and worship. Let's pray. that's you. As Wally would say, that's signature God. Holy, holy, holy. Executing judgment where it has to happen. After a lot of mercy. And then still showing mercy. Still being merciful. Your ways far beyond our ways. We haven't got a snowball's chance of our logic leading and guiding us purely. But we see from your word about yourself that you are perfect, that you are truly holy and truly reliable, truly gracious. Thank you that you are who you are, and you've disclosed yourself to us in your word and in your Son.